You are listening to Social Europe Podcast. We discuss cutting-edge thinking on politics, economy, and employment and labour with some of the most thought-provoking people around, including Nobel Prize winners and other internationally acclaimed experts. So welcome and enjoy the conversation.
This episode of Social Europe Podcast is brought to you by the Zayed Business School, University of Oxford. Maximize your effectiveness in the changing global business environment with the postgraduate Oxford Diploma in Global Business. Taught in four short modules over a year, the program is designed to accelerate your career and increase your impact while minimizing the disruption to your work and family life. Learn alongside senior executives from around the world and develop a lifelong network. Visit the Oxford Diploma in Global Business website to find out more. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Social Europe Podcast. My name is Henning Meyer, Editor-in-Chief of Social Europe. Today, we're recording the 50th episode of Social Europe Podcast. That's right, we've reached half a century of podcast episodes, and thank you very much indeed for listening to all of these episodes, and I hope you received some information that you found useful. To mark this half century, today I'm in conversation with Cass Mudde, who is the Stanley Wade Sheldon Professor of International Affairs at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia. You might know Cass from his column in the Guardian newspaper and as one of the world's leading experts on right-wing populism and right-wing extremism. As always, I hope you enjoy the conversation. Okay, Cass Mudde, thank you very much indeed for taking the time today to speak to me about the far right and far right politics in our times. And you're an acclaimed expert on the subject. And in order to get us going, based on the new book that you've got coming out just about now, you are arguing that we are actually in the fourth wave of what you call the post-war right-wing politics. Maybe as by way of background, what would you characterize as the first three waves of post-war right-wing politics? And before we come to the fourth one.
Yeah, so the German political scientist Klaus von Beimer wrote already in 1988 that we were in the third wave of the far right, of the post-war far right in Europe. And he said that the first wave was so-called neo-fascism that mostly lasted from 1945 to 1955, roughly. And those were really, there was nothing neo about it. These were just fascists. These were people who had been active in Italian fascist movement, German Nazi movement, or collaborators of that, and who are mostly social groups taking care of widows, orphans, as well as people that lost political rights. And there were one or two parties like the Italian social movement in Italy, the only successful one, and the Socialist Reich Party in Germany that was banned in 1952. And then a second wave started roughly in the mid-1950s and lasted until the 1980s. It was kind of an amorphous wave of right-wing populist groups that were a hybrid of old and new far-right politics. They had a lot of people who used to be active in the fascist groups. They had some issues related to that, but they were largely populist movements against changes in society. And the most important were the Pujadistes in France, and most of them were flash parties. They had initial success and then disappeared. And then in 1980, we started the third wave, which is parties like Front National, the FPÖ in Austria. And these were modern parties. They had a few people who had also been active in fascist groups, but mostly they were new leaders and they were busy with issues that were post-war issues like immigration and unemployment. And they were seen as challengers. They came from the outside. They were small. They were new. And they were challenging the political mainstream.
And coming to the fourth wave that you now characterize. So what if you look at today's far-right politics, and maybe we should also sort of introduce a distinction. What would you make a distinction between far-right politics and far-right populism, or the term populism? So maybe it's probably a term that is being used too often. So maybe introducing some sort of distinction would make sense. So how would you make these distinctions between the fourth wave of far-right politics and what is often referred to as right-wing populism?
Yeah, so I use the term far-right as a container concept for both the extreme right and the radical right. And the extreme right is against democracy per se. So they're against popular sovereignty, majority rule. They're against the idea that people elect their own leaders. And we can think here about fascists and Nazis in particular. And then the radical right, they do accept popular sovereignty, majority rule. They have problems with liberal democracy, particularly with minority rights, with rule of law, separation of powers. Now, it's within that category of the radical right that there are quite a lot of populist movements. Now, populists believe that the people are homogenous and pure, and, as are the elite, and they believe that they are the voice of all the people. The radical right doesn't have to be populist, but in today's world, most radical right groups are populist. That is not to say that most populists are radical right. You have left-wing populists like Podemos or Chavez, and you have kind of amorphous type populist like the Five Star Movement. So populism is a part of the radical right, but it is both less and more. With regard to the fourth wave, which I believe started kind of in the 2000s, there's a difference in a variety of ways. Most importantly, it is their role in the system. And so they are still largely the same ideologically. So the Rassemblement National of Marine Le Pen is fundamentally not so much different from Front National of Jean-Marie Le Pen. But whereas Jean-Marie Le Pen was a challenger to the system, and his values and his discourse was kind of separated from the mainstream, contemporary radical right parties have become much more mainstreamed, and they've also become normalized. And so those are two different processes. But my argument is that the fourth wave is different, because during the third wave, they were challengers to the mainstream, and now they are part of the mainstream.
So trying to undermine the system from within, or being a part of it and just capturing the system?
Kind of both. It's difficult to say, because in certain cases, they do change the system fundamentally. If we think about Fidesz in Hungary, they have reformed the liberal democratic system first into an illiberal democratic system. And now we could argue that it's not even democratic anymore, and it's competitive authoritarian. On the other hand, when the FPÖ in Austria went into the government in 2000, they by and large just became part of the system and barely reformed it. It has a lot to do with how much power they have. Like, and so traditionally, the radical right parties have been junior partners in coalition, in broader coalitions. As a consequence, they couldn't really do what they really wanted to. With regard to like Fidesz in Hungary, we see, in a sense, what the populist radical right would do if they have the whole power.
So you, basically, maybe you're saying that proportional representation systems might be a bit more resilient against these threats. And first-past-the-post system, I'm not referring to the UK right at the moment, but first-past-the-post system, because they tend to give one party majority, might be more vulnerable?
Well, it depends. So I mean, first-past-the-post is winner-takes-all, right? And that generally means that for a long time, the radical right doesn't get anything. But when they win it all, right? And so I think the U.S. is a very good example. In a proportional system, we wouldn't have had like so much power in the hands of a far-right politician. Or for that matter, Brazil, where like Bolsonaro becomes president, whereas in a proportional system, his party would be like a relatively minor player. So proportionality has done is actually brought small parties into the political system. Now, that can be good and bad. Quite a lot of radical right parties pretty much fell apart directly after entering parliament. Germany is a good example. I mean, almost all of those parties from Deutsche Volksunion to Republikaner, by and large, like as soon as they won, they lost, right? Because they got internal struggles and splits. But others built from that, and they started out small and became bigger and bigger. So it's not so much about the system. It's about the interaction of the system and the specific far-right actor.
And before we come to this, because that always also relates to how to deal with far-right politics, but I think, you know, one of the very interesting points in your book is that you're trying to make a sort of paint a global picture of far-right politics. So we are, I mean, Europe, we're obviously very much concerned with European politics, maybe on the transatlantic spectrum plus Trump. But where would you see, if you look at cases like you mentioned Brazil, there's also India. If you look at those cases and across the globe, where would you see our commonalities and where would you see regional differences and specific aspects that should be considered in each specific region?
Well, I'm not sure whether it's necessarily regions rather than countries, and sometimes even regions within countries. So while it is true that there are some general phenomena, global phenomena like globalization or growing ethnic diversity that impact the radical right and the far right globally, if you want to understand why Trump won or why Bolsonaro won or why BJP just got like reelected, national factors play a major role. Like, I mean, you can't understand Brazil without the PT imploding over corruption and all kinds of scandals. You can't understand the win of Trump without the primary system. And so I worry a little bit about these really global type visions, but also to a certain extent regionally, because outside of Europe, they're not clearly regional phenomenon. So there are a few far-right groups of relevance in Asia, which are primarily in India and Israel, and a little bit in Japan, but already more complex. But in many countries, you don't have it, right? And the same at the moment in Latin America, you have Bolsonaro, and then you have one or two other actors, like Haas in Chile, but they're nothing like Bolsonaro in terms of success or necessarily background. And you have Trump in the US, but you have no one in Canada, right? So in that sense, I think it's important to understand that the far right is not a purely European phenomenon. At the same time, in sheer numbers, right, it clearly is much more relevant and broadly relevant in Europe than it is in any other context.
And interestingly, because that would be my next question. You know, we talked about the characteristics of this fourth wave of far right politics. And if we maybe look to Europe, because you mentioned already so what happened in Brazil and, you know, implosion of existing parties and so on and so forth, what would you characterize maybe in Europe specifically as the necessary circumstances? So what were the circumstances that allowed this fourth wave of far-right politics to resurface again? I mean, if you look across Europe, there's clearly some sort of, I wouldn't say trend, but similar experiences. And one explanation that was put forward, interestingly, it was by Jürgen Habermas, wrote a piece for us 2 years ago, 3 years ago, where he basically made an argument that it could be seen as an unintended consequence of the reform of social democratic politics. So his argument basically is that by adopting to the conservative neoliberal mainstream, democratic pluralism was condensed to such a small space that this opened up the opportunities for far-right actors to actually move into that void, because people got the feeling that, you know, no matter what I vote for, the system is not really changing that very much. So that's the feeling that, you know, participation in the democratic system might not change circumstances. And if you're not generally happy with the direction of travel, so it's after two decades, you lose trust in the electoral system to actually affect something to this effect. And then he basically said, so if that is your feeling, where else would you go rather than into the irrational areas to unload this discontent and try something new? So that was at least one explanation why, you know, what the circumstances for the rise of far-right politics in Europe could be. But maybe you have a different view on this?
It's a very popular one. But the question where else can you go? They could go to Die Linke, right? And so this is the same argument at the moment. It's an argument that we have had now for 4 or 5 decades, pretty much. It's like, and this idea, well, people are dissatisfied, particularly with the fact that the major parties are the same, center-right and center-left, particularly when center-left adopted neoliberalism. And they're losers of globalization. So, like, they go to the radical right. And so in the U.S., they go to Trump. But why wouldn't they go to Sanders? Sanders is a much more critical, like, voice of globalization and of the economic part, right? And so all research shows that if there's one issue that jumps out for voters of the radical right, wherever it's, or at least in Europe and North America, it's immigration. Now, immigration and economic anxiety are not necessarily separated. For many people, they intermingle, but it is at the very least the racialization of economic anxiety that drives them to the radical right. Like, if you have mainly an economic worry, you see what we saw in the south of Europe after the Great Recession, which is left-wing populism. But if you think that it is part of a broader cultural change, then you go to the radical right. And it's important that the Great Recession did not necessarily boost the radical right that much electorally. Whereas the so-called refugee crisis, and I believe the most important one being the 9/11 crisis, did much more. And so we talk all the time about crises, and the term is problematic. But roughly in the 21st century, we've had 3 crises: the 9/11 crisis, the Great Recession, and the so-called refugee crisis. Of these 3, I think the 9/11 crisis was the most important for the switch from the 3rd to the 4th wave.
In what way?
Because the 9/11 crisis prioritized social cultural issues and made Islamophobia, as well as identity worries about immigration, mainstream, which opened up what they call discursive opportunity, opportunities for the far right, which up until then had pretty much been like anti-Turkish or anti-Moroccan, which only made sense in an ethnic nationalist discourse. Afterwards, it shifted to an ethno-religious kind of Islamophobia, which made sense in a security discourse, which was shared by the right, as well as a kind of a defense of liberal democracy, gender rights, separation state of church, those kind of things. And that by and large opened up the mainstream discourse to a radical right argument.
So the clash of civilization thesis from Huntington, I mean, there wasn't an Islamic Chinese alliance as he, you know, described in the book, but that was popularized, or basically there was a catalyst when you actually blame a whole religious group for ill. So you created a conflict line that, as you said, moved from being actually more nationalist because it was pinned down in terms of countries to more a specific religious group. And then presumably the next crisis, the economic financial crisis, that sort of put the economic fault lines in focus. And where would you see the refugee crisis then sort of brought these two together?
Well, I think if you look purely at the results of far-right parties in Europe, the Great Recession didn't really do much. Some parties won, others lost. I think more than anything, what that did was fuel populism in general and kind of kill what I've called the broader integration consensus that we have had, which was an economic integration like neoliberalism, a national integration, European integration, and then a multicultural one. And in the Great Recession, killed by and large the European utopia, not in the sense that it killed the idea of European integration. It killed the idea that European integration had no negative effects. And so that, of course, helped the far right because people were more open to looking at alternatives. The immigration, so-called immigration crisis, was fundamental for the far right because it was really the perfect storm. So most radical right parties are nativist, authoritarian, and populist. Now, the nativism was clear. Like, there were over a million foreigners coming, aliens, most notably Muslims. And so that was directly there. Then it was at the same time as we had terrorist attacks in Brussels and Paris. And mainstream politicians and media connected the two, which is exactly what the radical right has always done, connect crime and immigration. And so in there, it played on their authoritarianism. And then populism, in the sense that politicians, like particularly national politicians, were seen as not taking care of their people because they bowed to the EU, which has to do with the Schengen area, and the argument that they would come in because of the EU, and that national politicians were not willing to create borders again, right? Because they found Brussels more important than their own population. So it was the perfect storm for them, and it had a massive effect, although it started to wane already at the end of 2016.
And if I understand you correctly, so you think amongst the two, you know, all very often cited drivers of right-wing politics, socioeconomic circumstances and cultural aspects, you would prioritize the cultural elements?
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't say that economic anxiety doesn't play a role, right? My argument is that cultural backlash plays a role for virtually all voters. Economic anxiety for only a part of the voters, and you see that very clearly in the more successful radical right parties, which, yes, they have generally, they're overrepresented among the lower educated, not necessarily the poor, right, but among lower educated, and they're very underrepresented in the higher educated and the richest. But the vast majority of voters for the radical right hold jobs and have decent incomes. And actually, what we see in a lot of polls is that they say that their own economic situation is good, but they think that the economic situation of the country is bad. The question is that an economic assessment, or is that related to their nativism? If you're a nativist and you think that a lot of Muslims come in, you think your country is not doing well, right? In all aspects. And so this is where I speak about like a racialized view of the economy.
Mm. So the economic argument might be a proxy for actually underlying cultural anxieties.
Yeah. And let's be clear, if it goes economically great, right, then fewer people might have their nativism drive their vote, right? And so it does play a role in that respect. But generally, if the discourse, if the political debate is first and foremost socioeconomic, radical right parties tend to not do very well because they actually don't have much to say on socioeconomic issues.
Hmm. And it's interesting. I mean, this fits with the observations that we have at the moment, say, in Germany. I mean, the AfD doing well in regional elections, even though the economic situation, I mean, the economy might be cooling off. But as it is, everybody or most people are pretty well off. But there is the fear about the future. You can also see it in the kind of strange alliances, not in election, but in votes. If you look at the Brexit vote, you know, the socioeconomic arguments might hold for the deindustrialized areas in Northern England, but not necessarily for Sevenoaks in Kent, which is a sort of rich London southeast commuter town. So you have these alliances from exactly what you say. Some people might have the socioeconomic concerns drive their vote based on the cultural identity, and others just say, you know, I'm doing well, but I fear for the future, and you know, this is mainly culturally rooted.
Yes, absolutely, and. I mean, sorry, I don't think I see neither the Brexit vote nor the Trump vote as pure radical right votes or populist votes for that matter, because I mean, first and foremost, the Trump vote was a Republican vote And the main driver of Brexit was still the Conservative Party rather than the UKIP or the Brexit Party. But you see similar sentiments. And so that's one of the problematic aspects of some of the responses where people just thought, okay, we just have to ride out this great recession and then everything will be fine, right? It won't be, because that's only a small part of the reason. But I also think we have very stereotypical views of who is the radical right, like who's the radical right voter. The radical right voter is always this kind of lower educated, angry, like working class male, right? Now, yes, the working class or the radical right voter is male. In almost all countries, about for every female voter, you have two male voters. They're also white, right? But they're not particularly working class. Only in a few cases there is a very strong part of the electorate is working class. And actually, they're not necessarily angry either.
So this is a stereotype.
It is absolutely a stereotype. I mean, many are disappointed or frustrated, right? But some just want something else, and they just try this, right? Benjamin Barber, the American philosopher, already like 20 years ago, had this thesis that, like, particularly because Pim Fortuyn was successful in the Netherlands in the early 2000s, said, well, the Dutch are just bored. Right? It was just kind of bratty, bored kids. Now, I think that's a bit too far, but there's some anecdotal evidence of people who are actually pretty well off, and who just think, let's try this. Shake things up. And if you're really privileged, like you're a rich white man, you can do that. Because if it by and large screws up, you're not paying the price, right? And so there were interviews with voters of Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, and they said that, I'm just going to give him a try. And if it doesn't work out, then I'll get someone else, right? Whereas we often think about them as very dedicated followers, right? We act as if everyone who voted for Trump believes that Trump can shoot someone, can kill someone in Times Square and get away with it. And the vast majority of people who vote for Trump or for the FBI or for the FN have a similar type of complex relationship to their party as other parties. And even within parties, there's differences. I mean, in the last regional elections in Germany, like what we saw was in Saxony, 70% of people had voted for the AfD voted to support the AfD, whereas in Brandenburg, about 60% of people who voted for the AfD said they voted to send a signal to the other parties, right? So it really is much more complex than this one stereotypical story.
So, and that leads us nicely into the 1 million euro question, what to do about it. So if your assumption is that the more entrenched fundamental reason for the rise of far-right politics is the cultural one and the socioeconomic one is attached to it, but I mean, it obviously doesn't hurt if you try to do, you know, something about socioeconomics.
Sure.
But as, you know, across Europe, if you come back to Europe specifically, obviously the strategic response of progressive parties to right-wing populism has been all over the place, and nobody's really has really found a good solution. So what would be sort of the building blocks in your view of a strategy to counter the rise of far-right politics?
Yeah, to me the key thing is that the struggle is not against the radical right. The struggle is for liberal democracy, and those are two different struggles that have similar consequences in part. You can defeat the radical right very easily without strengthening liberal democracy. You can just ban them, right? If we would ban them, like, we don't in any way strengthen liberal democracy. If we strengthen liberal democracy, then by definition, the radical right will weaken. And so to me, this is about mainstream parties like going back to an ideological story and prioritizing the issues that they find important. That does not mean that we go back to the 80s, 90s in countries like Germany and the Netherlands, where we, by and large, ignore or even put a taboo on issues like immigration or European integration. These are important issues, but these are important issues among a long list of other important issues, like education, like the environment, like work in all kinds of healthcare. And so if we talk about the full range of issues, the radical right will already go down because they don't have anything particular to say on most issues. But for the last two decades, we have talked almost exclusively about their issues, immigration and security and identity, right? And so they seem very relevant. If that is just one out of seven issues, they're pretty much relevant in one of the seven discussions and irrelevant in the six others. So it's not necessarily about changing people's views. People are, like, there's a large part of the population, often the plurality, if not a majority, that are nativist, that see immigrants as threatening. That doesn't mean that they will always vote on nativist parties. For decades, they have been voting for social democratic parties, for Christian democratic parties, for whatever. Depends on what issues they vote on. So I think first and foremost, we should just have an ideological, diverse political debate again. On top of that, it is important that we are much more consistent in our discourse about immigration and immigrants. Like at the moment, whenever a German of Turkish descent commits a crime, he's a Muslim. Whenever he scores a goal, he's a German. That type of behavior, right, sets a certain discourse, a narrative that has effects, right? But we should not endlessly copy the radical right. And this is what the SPD at the moment wants to do in Germany and says, well, like, we lose all our voters to the AfD. We have to, like, get tougher on immigration, protect our own workers, right? Now, there are all kinds of problems. First of all, no, you don't actually lose all of your voters to the AfD. You lose them mostly to the Greens, right? Second of all, like, these issues are owned by the radical right. Even if you're tougher on them, people who find these issues the most important will not come back to you, and actually they are not from you. These voters, even if they were working class, never voted for you. Right? This is the part of the working class that always voted right wing. And finally, what is the social democratic message behind it? Like, you don't have to be for open borders, right? But you should think about immigration and multiculturalism from a social democratic point of view, in which your solidarity is with the weak, irrespective of culture or color, right? And if you do that, like, your agenda should be driven by class first and identity second. And this is something that is the only future in my belief for social democratic parties. It is to accept that the working class is diverse, and that they first and foremost have social, like, class issues rather than identity issues.
I mean, it's interesting because there's luckily, I think in the SPD, the debate is advancing beyond that. And it conflates with the issue that what is the working class today? I mean, given how the world of work is changing, and there's somebody who works for, say, Volkswagen or Mercedes-Benz and has a very high paid job, really anything in common with, say, a cleaner or somebody like that. And it's interesting also, I mean, what would you see about the strategy? I always think that if you talk about immigration, you need to really need to break it down and identify the areas where there are the conflicts. Because if you look at immigration, you can broadly define it as freedom of movement within the European Union. At least in Germany, nobody's got an issue with that.
Right.
You got from non-EU immigration. Then you can pass a law. We need non-EU immigration as well because we need skilled workers. Right. The problematic part seems to be specifically asylum. Mm-hmm. Right. So, and for this, you need a European approach. Obviously, Angela Merkel has not pursued a European agenda before it was too late. But I mean, and that's what always a problem that I identified also in the UK, which I thought didn't help. If you just conflate immigration with everything, I mean, in the UK, it was to an extent the Polish plumber that came over and you know was perceived to steal UK jobs. Well, if the Polish plumber is leaving, they will find out that you know they didn't steal jobs, but actually fulfilled jobs that were absolutely necessary. But in most European countries, for instance, freedom of movement is not, we might say, not yet question to that extent. I mean, but you know, but you see how these issues get conflated. You saw Denmark reinstating, you know, controls at a Schengen border because of asylum, effectively, yeah. Right? So, and if you try to identify or so create a new policy on asylum, I think you know many other areas of immigration are not that contentious.
Well, maybe. Of course, a lot of the issue of asylum is directly related to the very strict economic immigration. Like, I mean, if you don't allow for economic immigration, people only have one way to come in, so you can't separate the two. I mean, I've argued already since the 1980s that West European countries should become openly immigration countries, in which... And for two reasons. I mean, first of all, I think it is a social justice issue rather than economics issue. Second of all, it's about control. Like, I mean, politics is about managing. And one of the reasons why people are so upset about immigration is because they feel that it's out of control. And so when you officially argue that you're not an immigration country and yet you have a lot of immigrants, then logically, a lot of people feel like, okay, so they're here even though they shouldn't be, so something is not working. If you manage it, I think for part of the population, they will be, okay, so that's fine. Think just back to the so-called refugee crisis. Like, the Turkey deal didn't necessarily change that much of who was there, right? I mean, still about 1 million asylum seekers were in Germany. But the feeling was, we have it under control again. Right? Now, there are all kind of moral issues with the Turkey deal, but that is the key issue of it. Right? It created at least the illusion of mainstream parties having control of the immigration issue again. And then it turns out that a large portion of people like are okay. Like, even the people who will prefer to not have had 1 million asylum seekers, it's not a major issue for them. It's not make or break. They just want to know that the government is in control of this issue. And so if we do that, we should definitely look at the different categories, like as in that sense, Angela Merkel has always done. She's very open towards refugees. She's not very open towards economic immigrants. I think it is important lessons from like Daniel Cohn-Bendit, and I think it was Thomas Schmidt, wrote a book 3 or 4 decades ago called Heimat Babylon, in which they argued against defining immigration purely in terms of economic gain for the host community. Because in that case, you get what we had in the 70s, 80s, which is by and large an unemployed guest worker, right? And it doesn't make sense. If their only purpose is to advance our economic success, then if they don't have a job or a good job, right, they don't have any purpose or rights in our society. And so I think it is important to define immigration in whatever capacity, first and foremost in terms of human terms and social justice. And the fact that it also has economic advantages is a plus, but shouldn't be the foundation.
And coming back to a point that we alluded to at the beginning, you know, when these far-right politicians enter parliaments, how do you deal with them? Do you sort of isolate them in parliaments? I mean, there is obviously, some say isolation is the strategy. Others say, you know, have them as part of a government or part of a deal, and then they will get disenchanted. You know, voters will see that they cannot deliver. So what evidence is there for what kind of strategy works best?
Well, the evidence shows that there is not one strategy that works best. It depends a lot on the party itself. And so there are very badly organized parties like the Lisbon for Time. And so if you take those into government, they will directly split. But Lega Nord has been in government several times and never split. There are other examples. Danish People's Party supported three different governments in a row. Not only didn't split, they didn't moderate, and they didn't lose votes. First of all, you don't take a party you dislike into government to break it. Like, that's the craziest thing to do. But at the same time, the rise of the radical right comes at a time of increased fragmentation of our party systems. And that changes the way that we govern. Like, so the radical right, on average, wins about 10% of the vote, which is not much. Right? However, 10% or 15% of the vote today makes you the second or third biggest party because of the fragmentation. Now, that means that if you're going to like systematically exclude that party, you probably need to have at least three, if not four, parties to constitute a government. You need to take those things into account. And so at this point in time, it is irresponsible for every individual party to not think about their strategy towards the radical right. I think every single party should think under which conditions they're willing to work with the radical right. And those conditions will be different for social democrats than from conservatives. But it's important that you enter coalitions under your terms, and those terms should always be liberal democracy. That should never be like given up. And in that sense, like ÖVP in Austria, like absolutely failed. Like, I mean, their internal minister like had razzias in the intelligence service, etc., which they could have known, right? But they didn't think about it. But I'm not necessarily for a cordon sanitaire. I don't think that it's viable in many structures to live around the radical right. But that also doesn't mean that I believe you should just work with them and hope that they implode. Like, for a party like the ÖVP, it makes sense to govern with the FPÖ because they're ideologically pretty similar by now. For a party like the Greens, it doesn't.
The key point is maybe by now, how is actually the far-right politics changing conservative parties? I mean, if you look at what is happening at the moment to the Tories, it's quite breathtaking that the grandson of Winston Churchill apparently no longer has space in the British Conservative Party.
Yeah, and this is also one of the points I make about the fourth wave. Like, in the fourth wave, that's come a growing separation of radical right politics and radical right parties. Radical right politics, nativist politics, authoritarian politics, populist politics, now not only come from the radical right, it also comes from conservative parties, it comes from social democratic parties, like in Denmark. And in certain cases, the boundaries are just not clear anymore. Like, we regularly see the Norwegian Progress Party as a radical right party. And yet it stands on immigration is definitely like not more extreme than of CSU in Germany, of the VVD in the Netherlands, and is much less than the Conservative Party in the UK or the Republicans. You have this transformation in the case of particularly Fidesz, like where a Conservative Party just becomes far right. I think the same happened with Law and Justice. I think the same happened with Likud in Israel, and I think the same is happening with the Republican Party. And so this is a really very different political context and space than we had in the 80s, 90s.
Okay, and to wrap the things up, if somebody now comes off this conversation and thinks, okay, where do we start? If you were sort of advising progressive policy actors, what would your top three priorities be? So start here, go on with this, and finish or go on further with this. Top three priorities.
Well, the first one is actually to get informed. Get informed about why do you lose and why does the radical right win, so that you don't make the mistake of basing your policies on this mythical idea that like you have lost the white working class voter to the radical right. Second of all, you have to think, what is the essence of the system? of the system that we, what's the essence of liberal democracy? Where can we have a debate about which is beyond debate? And then third, what do I stand for? What is social democracy in the 21st century? And only if you know what you stand for, can you be a steadfast, like either opponent or collaborator of the radical right. But at this point in time, like parties have to get, many of the politicians live in the spirit of the third wave. They still think that the mainstream is liberal, democratic, relatively open, and that the radical right is somewhere that challenges from the outside. And that by and large ignores reality and strengthens the radical right.
Kasmude, thank you very much again for taking the time to talk to me. I'm sure this topic is not going to go away anytime soon, so maybe we'll do an update in a year's or 2 years' time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Make sure you don't miss future episodes by subscribing to Social Europe Podcast. You can also read our articles on www.socialeurope.eu and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter @Social Europe. Until next time.